This is the Soundcheck Podcast. We're online at soundcheck.org.
Try to think that love's not around. Still, it's uncomfortably near.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And you probably don't need me to tell you who this is. They called him Old Blue Eyes and the chairman of the board, but some people called him less flattering names. Frank Sinatra was one of the great voices of the 20th century and a complicated guy. This year marks the 100th anniversary of Sinatra's birth, and the Oscar-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney is unveiling a two-night, four-hour documentary about him on HBO. It's called Sinatra, All or Nothing at All, and it brings Alex Gibney back to the Soundcheck studio. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks, John. Good to be back.
Before we start talking about Sinatra, let me just ask you about you and music, because, you know, last time you were here is the James Brown documentary. Yeah. You did Fela Kuti. Way back, the rock band Three Doors Down. What do you look for in, you know, when you're choosing a musical subject?
Well, a lot of my films actually have a lot of music in them, too, even the ones that are not just about music. So I'm just the ultimate music fan. Mm-hmm. Never, you know, had the talent to be a musician, but a huge musical fan. And so, but usually in terms of the music docs, what I look for is the story. The story is what's interesting. You know, I produced this, another two-parter called The History of the Eagles. And what was interesting to me about that was the story and taking it through that kind of epic period in the 70s in California. Fela Kuti had the most incredible story. So, and when it comes to Sinatra, oh, well, and James Brown had a fantastic story.
Yeah,
but when it comes to Sinatra, what a story. It's the Great Gatsby. You know, the kid from Hoboken who comes across the river and makes it big, you know, beyond his wildest dreams. You know, I just thought that was that's the stuff the dreams are made of.
Yeah. So even Enron and the Elliot Spitzer doc and Taxi to the Dark Side, all of those, are you driven by music even when you're doing non-musical documentaries?
A lot of times I am. I mean, if in the case of Enron, for example, I listened to lots and lots and lots of songs and tried to find, you know, what song would be right for Ken Lay, what song for Jeff Skilling, what song for Andy Fastow. I think that was Dear Mr. Fantasy, was Andy Fastow. And so, you know, each one is different. I mean, I did a doc recently called Going Clear.
Right, the Scientology doc.
About Scientology. Yeah. In that one, it's almost more composed music. Because I wanted more of a mindscape rather than bits and pieces. But sometimes I use songs as a kind of toe-tapping Greek chorus to comment on the action, and because it's fun.
Well, now, you talk about, you know, you're looking for the stories, and the story of Sinatra has a neat kind of framing device that you use for this two-part series. His 1971 retirement concert, where he chooses a playlist of 11 songs. Now, do you see that as 11 songs specifically chosen to kind of sum up his life and career?
I think so. I mean, we don't know for sure that he even defined it like that. We know from his daughter, Tina, that, you know, he was working on the set list over and over and over again on a legal pad and wouldn't show it to her and didn't really unveil it until that night. But I took that as a he never really wrote an autobiography. Mm-hmm. He tried, and we have a lot of audio tapes from his attempts that are in the film. So I just took that as his autobiography for that moment in time, and it seemed to me a way of focusing in on a way to tell the story, you know, 11 songs to tell the story of a life.
Well, what they also do, I mean, this is 1971. This
right.
is Sinatra towards the end of his career.
Peak of his career.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
At a time where, you know, he is seen by a younger generation as, you know, the old guard, parents' music. I know that's how I saw him.
That's how I saw him. And even when I came to this, you know, that was my memory of it. And yeah, it was the old stuff.
Yeah. However, as late as 1971, there are moments in this performance, especially in the song All or Nothing at All,
right,
where he floats this low note.
Yeah.
And holds it, and it's just remarkable.
All or nothing at all. Half a love never appealed to me.
The night itself was star-studded and exciting and sad and a lot of mixed emotions.
All or nothing at all.
Oh, that is, that note is, the man still had it.
He did. And, you know, one of the things I learned about Sinatra, because as you say, you know, when I was, you know, a teenager, he was the old guard. But one of the things I learned about him was something technical and also something interesting from a story perspective. You know, he learned from Tommy Dorsey these breathing techniques that allowed him to carry a phrase in a way that wasn't just about how much breath could you hold in. It was all about what was right for the story in terms of the phrasing. And that led to the other part that I found so fascinating, particularly with the slower songs, the ballads. He was a master storyteller. A lot of these feel like little movies. You really get into the character. He gets into the moment. It doesn't feel like a lot of the other pop singers, you know, that were his contemporaries, that it's just sort of showy. Mm. He's really inside the story.
At his best, absolutely, yeah. Now, that was the voice we heard talking there was his daughter Nancy, right?
Correct.
Although we also hear from Tina and from Frank Jr.
Correct.
And from...
And from him, from Frank.
From him, from his first wife.
Right.
Lots of voices here. But, you know, the other thing, as I was saying, this 1971 concert shows that on occasion, he can still reach back and hold you with a note. But there are also moments where you hear why people like you and I at that age thought, this guy's... Like, and the song that, you know, to me kind of epitomizes that is The Lady is a Tramp. I mean, listen to this.
Never makes a trip up to Harlem, pushing shiny Lincolns and Fords. And she doesn't mess with those other broads. That's why this chick is a tramp. She loves the free, fine, wild, groovy, knocked out.
All right, Alex, you must remember Joe Piscopo doing Frank Sinatra
absolutely,
on Saturday Night.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is
that
everything
is
that Joe Piscopo was making fun of.
Right.
The chick is
it's a tramp. Right. Hey!
So did you feel, as you got into this project, that you were maybe rehabilitating the image of Frank Sinatra for our generation?
I guess so. I mean, I didn't go into it with that in mind, but I was interested in this character, in this, you know, who came from a rough-and-tumble place and actually stood for a lot of pretty important things. You know, he was really at the forefront in terms of the entertainment industry, in terms of advocating for equal rights for African Americans, for example. Very, very important. And he did this Academy Award-winning short, The House I Live In, that was all about racial prejudice.
Of course, you know, basically lifted Sammy Davis Jr. out of obscurity.
That's right.
That was a part of the story I was not aware of, and I was really impressed. There's a clip in the film of Sinatra talking about why he sort of, how he came to feel this way.
I really became conscious of segregation when I got involved in the entertainment business. I found that going through parts of the United States, traveling constantly and doing one-nighters with orchestras that were comprised of Negro musicians, there were a lot of problems. And not only the South, but in some quarters in the border states. And I began to resent it. I think it's vile. I think it's most indecent way to believe. I think that we're all created equal. It's wrong. It's just basically wrong.
So that was pretty progressive.
Very
for
progressive.
The time and the place.
It was really interesting to me, you know, a lot of the interviews, I didn't actually shoot any interviews on camera, but mm-hmm. we recorded on audio a lot of interviews, and one of them was with Harry Belafonte. And I was impressed with how deeply Harry felt about how much onside Sinatra was and how much help he gave to him and so many others in terms of breaking the race barrier in Las Vegas, where
right.
he had some unusual influence.
Yes.
but it was really impressive. He and Belafonte and Sinatra broke later on, particularly when Sinatra went Republican. For a long time, he was a kind of bedrock, you know, FDR and JFK Democrat
right.
who was really at the forefront of civil rights.
We're talking, of course, about Frank Sinatra, subject of Alex Gibney's two-part documentary on HBO. It premieres on April 5th and 6th, 8 p.m. both nights, and it's called Sinatra All or Nothing at All. You had 11 songs from that alleged farewell concert, and as we know, he came back later, but
right.
he did retire for a little while. You had 11 songs to choose from. You chose All or Nothing at All. Why?
That seemed to me to be the catchword for his life, all or nothing at all. It was like you were going to do it my way or you were not going to do it at all. It was like a sense of he jumped in or he jumped out. He was very hot and cold. He could be absolutely magnificently charming, and there are extraordinary stories of his generosity. He could also be very cruel.
And intimidating.
Intimidating. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be putting it mildly. Yeah.
The great Nelson Riddle talks, he's almost kind of stifling a laugh where he says something like, Frank would come in and conduct the orchestra. Maybe I wasn't crazy about it.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah. but at the same time, you know, Sinatra also got very much involved in terms of the way he wanted songs to be. And Riddle was very conscious of that he had a really powerful sense of melody and the construction of arrangements.
I really liked, you know, there were a couple of clips where Sinatra actually gets to the nut of the matter. And there's one moment where he talks about how he reacts to singing with an orchestra.
I may be one of the few people who performs in the middle of the orchestra, right in the studio. And no headphones and not a booth, a glassed-in booth. Because I need the drive of the orchestra.
All of me, come on.
A good arranger is terribly vital because he's a recording secretary. For instance, if you brought a song to me and I said, it's very good, maybe we'll record it. Then we'd bring in those days it was Axel, and then we went to Billy May and Nelson and then Gordon Jenkins. We would sit down and we would pick the key. And I would give him my thoughts on what the background should be from eight measures to eight measures. And then I would say, how wrong am I?
Left me with eyes that
dry. That's
he could be a charming guy.
Yeah,
I mean,
and that's storytelling through music. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and he clearly, he wasn't one of those people who didn't listen. He clearly mm-hmm. did listen a lot. And, you know, some of the great artists, great musical artists, are also great listeners.
Right.
And it's for somebody like Nelson Riddle, while there are stories about how he may have treated him badly later on, you know, he had a tremendous amount of respect for him, and there was a lot of back and forth. It wasn't strictly the chairman of the board. And I love that stuff about how he had to be inside the orchestra. Because then you get this real feel of call and response,
right.
a sense that the music drove him. And he wasn't just driving it. So,
now, you talk about, you know, Frank Sinatra telling a story in music. You, of course, are also telling a story in sound and visuals. And I know enough about sound that I can tell when a clip has been stitched together from two separate interviews, which is the case in that what we just heard from Sinatra there. So you found, you know, two divergent pieces that together tell a neat story about his working process. How hard was it to find this footage? You know, I mean, he's Sinatra. There's got to be a lot out there, but you seem to have found things that I hadn't heard or seen before.
Well, and we had a lot of help with the family. The family did give us materials, particularly long audio tapes where he was talking to other people, I think exploring the possibility of doing an autobiography. And sometimes you can hear, you know, forks falling off the table or glasses clinking, ice cubes, whatever. But and so it was difficult to get the sound quality right and to enhance it. And Tommy Fleischman did an extraordinary job of doing that. But we had this unbelievable wealth of material of him talking about his own life in a very kind of intimate setting, which allows us to use Sinatra as kind of the undependable but very charming narrator of his own story.
An important distinction to make, because he is an unreliable narrator.
Right.
You keep coming back to this old interview with Walter Cronkite.
Yes.
Where he comes across as very affable and genial, but there's kind of a self-serving quality to it as well.
That's one of those arch interviews, which is fun to listen to because it's very much of the time and in the moment, but it's a very sort of stagey. It's not to me as interesting as the other stuff, the stuff that the family gave us, and also this wonderful lecture he gave at Yale, of all places, where he's telling these stories about, you know, the first time that he got a dime for singing a song in a bar. And he said, that's the racket, you know.
But you also have, I mean, Mia Farrow seems to be, that interview seems to be her on the phone with you.
That's correct.
And then at the very beginning of part one of the documentary is this really touching clip from Bruce Springsteen talking about how he first heard the voice of Frank Sinatra in a bar as his mom is dragging a young Bruce Springsteen from bar to bar looking for his dad.
That's right. What does he say? He said, that's Frank Sinatra. His mom tells him, that's Frank Sinatra. He's from New Jersey.
He's from New Jersey. Yeah. So he actually begins not as a soloist, not with an orchestra, but as part of a kind of put-together boy band.
The Hoboken Four.
The Hoboken Four.
The Three Aces, who became the Hoboken Four. Right.
And they get their big break on Major Bowes,
right,
who was like an amateur kind of radio TV host.
Right. Come on, boys, let's go.
He was pro, but he brought amateurs on. And I love this. Now, is this a rare clip of the Hoboken Four making their debut on Major Bowes?
Pretty rare. Pretty rare.
A number of things to listen for here. One of them being that Major Bowes is just like, yeah, go do, sing a dance, whatever it is you do. Yeah. Like he's not expecting much.
It's like, this is act number 25B, right.
This is some pretty old, pretty rare footage of Frank Sinatra, very early days.
Who will speak for the group?
I will. I'm Frank. We're looking for jobs. How about it? Everyone that's ever heard us liked us. We think we're pretty good.
All right, what do you want to sing or dance or whatever it is you do?
Oh, we're going to sing Shine.
All right, let's have it. Hoboken Four.
Shine and sway your bluesy. Why don't you shine? Start with your shoesy. Shine each place up. Make it look like new.
Boom, 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 boom.
Shine your face up. I want to see you wear a smile at you. Oh, shine. Your Z's and those
Z's. So somewhere in there is a probably teenage Frank Sinatra.
Right, yeah. He never finished high school.
And the Hoboken Four on Major Bowes, the kind of one of those amateur hour radio and TV shows that were so popular back in the 30s. So that from those humble beginnings, he works hard.
Really hard. And he's going through and he finds a vocal coach, and the vocal coach teaches him how to form his lips around certain syllables. And he doesn't want to betray, you know, that was a very important part in the 30s, say, you know, you didn't want to betray any kind of ethnic origins.
Yeah.
You know, you wanted to say things as in pure unaccented English and to wrap your mouth around phrases in ways that would be absolutely clear. So he did a lot of vocal exercises and then over time learned to breathe, you know, with Tommy Dorsey. He was always learning. It reminds you of the great athletes you see that come along. And they're great. They have a lot of natural talent, but they keep learning.
Mm-hmm.
They keep getting better and better and better, and all the weaknesses in their game disappear until suddenly they're at the height.
And Frank Sinatra would have several high points and several low points, as you recount in this documentary. Again, it's called Sinatra, All or Nothing at All, premiering on HBO April 5th and 6th at 8 p.m. The Oscar-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney with me on soundcheck. The Scientology documentary is out, going clear.
Right.
The Steve Jobs documentary is coming. you would have expected and indeed got a lot of controversy from the Scientology documentary. I think you can probably expect a lot from the Steve Jobs as well.
Right.
If you were thinking that the Frank Sinatra thing was going to steer clear of controversy, you probably didn't think that very long.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, look, there are all these third rails in the Frank Sinatra story, and maybe the biggest of the third rails is the mob.
Right.
And we certainly get into that part of the story. Particularly, look, I think a lot of people know the story, but either a lot of people don't know it or a lot of people have forgotten the connection with the mob and JFK and the election of John F. Kennedy. We don't think of today, we think of JFK as Camelot and all that.
Right.
You don't think that Joe Kennedy goes to Frank Sinatra and said, would you please put a word in with your pal Sam Giancana, who was a noted killer. I mean, not just a rum runner. He was a killer. And ask him to swing the primary election in West Virginia. And then for the general election, you know, maybe you could help us out a little bit in Chicago, in Illinois, where we need some help. That's what Giancana did. And there's no doubt that it would be hard to know if Kennedy would be president today if Sinatra had not intervened with the mob.
So Sinatra cuts a version of the song High Hopes with JFK lyrics.
That's right.
Everyone is voting for Jack because he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track.
But then there's the dark side of what he did for JFK.
That's right.
And then, you know, there's this kind of weird relationship with Robert F. Kennedy, who is seriously anti-mob.
Well, the mob, I think, expected a quid pro quo. It's hard to believe that this would that they would be thinking that. But they thought, look, we helped the guy get elected, so maybe he'll go easy on us and they'll turn a blind eye when it comes to whatever we're doing in Vegas or elsewhere. But instead, JFK appoints Bobby as the attorney general, and he becomes this vicious anti-mob crusader. I don't say vicious in a bad way. I mean, he was going after them hard, but I mean, he's really, there's a scene we have in the film where he's mercilessly mocking Sam Giancana. It's like, you're just giggling now. It's little girls who giggle, isn't it, Mr. Giancana?
Because he's refusing. He's taking the fifth.
He's taking the fifth. That's right. But then there's a poignant moment for Sinatra where he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to upgrade his compound in Palm Springs for a visit that he was going to get from JFK. He had the red phone installed and everything else. And just a little bit before the visit, they announced that it would be improper because Mr. Sinatra had connections with the mob. So they were going to stay at Bing Crosby's house, who had been, you know, Sinatra's rival and was a Republican. Mm. So it was a real slap in the face. But the irony, the bitter irony that the Kennedys couldn't be associated with somebody who was associated with the mob, you know, after.
And the idea that this mobster and JFK share a girlfriend.
That's right. And this mobster, JFK and Sinatra all shared the same girlfriend.
Yeah. Early on in the documentary, Sinatra, I believe this is the Cronkite interview, talks about going to Havana and seeing a couple of mobsters there. And his explanation to Cronkite is, and in one moment, you know, all my years of good behavior go out the window because I happen to be in the same room as these guys.
Right.
Now, later on, he tells someone else, well, of course I knew these guys. I grew up with them. You know, right. We're all from the same neighborhood. So the story was
shifts.
A malleable one.
No, it's clear that he knew them and was friendly with them. And indeed, there's a funny moment that Belafonte recounts where basically Sinatra muscled the mob and Belafonte was at a breakfast where he was like, you guys got to give some money to the NAACP. And it's the idea of the mafia supporting Martin Luther King. I mean, that is rich with irony.
So now one of the stories that I either had never heard of or had forgotten was Frank Sinatra Jr. at age 19 being kidnapped.
Yeah.
And, you know, suddenly Robert F. Kennedy is on the phone to Frank Sinatra saying, hey, we're doing everything we can. I mean, I'm sure for a few hours at least, everyone thought, oh, it must be a mob thing. It turned out not to be. But
turned out to be a crazy guy who had a business plan. I mean, he didn't even, the Barry Keenan, the kidnapper, didn't even see it as ransom. For him, it was a kind of a loan.
Right.
Sinatra offered to pay $1 million to get his son back. He said, no, I don't want $1 million. $240,000 will be sufficient, thank you. And in his own mind, he thought, but it'll be okay because I'll pay it back.
Right.
It's just, I just need a grub stake to get my business off the ground. It's crazy.
Yeah. So much of this story is, you know, just unfathomable. And to many people who saw Sinatra supporting FDR,
right,
and then supporting both above the table and below boards JFK, for him to then turn around and support Reagan and Nixon's reelection must have just been, you know, a complete mind blower.
Was certainly a mind blower for Harry Belafonte, and he talks about it. You know, it was just like they felt that he went over to the other side.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nixon was not exactly, you know, Frank Sinatra, you know, when he was an FDR Democrat, he was always looking out for the little guy. Well, you wouldn't call Richard Nixon or Spiro Agnew, his vice president, people who looked out for the little guy. So it's very hard to understand. Even Tina, his daughter, says, I don't understand Nixon. But Mia Farrow was there right in that moment when he was making the change. And for a long time, he was on top of the culture. He kind of ruled the culture. And then I think in the late 60s, early 70s, the popular culture kind of leaves him behind. And that's why where you and I came into it, you know, we saw him as kind of a representative of the old guard without an understanding of what had come before.
So there's a couple of fun allusions to that, you know, the idea that Elvis Presley comes along and people are like, oh, when have you ever seen girls scream like this? And Sinatra's got his hand, hey, guys over here.
Right.
You know? There's a great clip from New Year's Eve, 1942. When Benny Goodman has done his set, and then Frank Sinatra is going to come on stage, and well, let's let Sinatra tell the story.
Benny did a whole section of music, and then he would finish that section with sing, 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 and it was round. He would tear the joint. It ran about 8 minutes. He finished sing, 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 and he took a bow, and he went over to the microphone, and he said, "No, Frank Sinatra." And they screamed like a banshee. And he turned around and he looked at the audience and he said to nobody, "What the fuck was that?" he said.
Now that's a storyteller. I mean, it must have been a gas, you know, sitting with Sinatra just telling those stories. You know, that
I was wondering how you got all the salty language that we hear throughout this documentary, because, you know, in broadcast interviews, that would
it
never
wasn't
have
a
been.
Broadcast interview. It was just him sitting down with somebody, maybe with the makings of a book. It was never to have been broadcast.
Yeah. Oh man. So that's 1942. In the fullness of time, Elvis Presley comes along, and I think it's the Cronkite interview where Walter Cronkite or someone asks Sinatra, "Well, don't you think in 1995 some gray-haired couple is going to hear an Elvis Presley song and say, 'Hey, that was our song'" and Sinatra says, No.
No,
I don't think so.
That rock and roll is not here to stay. He was convinced it was a passing fad.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then as the 60s gain steam and, as you say, the culture begins to pass him by, he's got this TV show and he finds himself with Elvis Presley.
You do witchcraft, okay, and I'll do one of the other ones. Okay, Nelson. Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so.
Those fingers in my hair, fly, come hither, stare. That strips my conscience bare, it's a witchcraft.
Love me tender, love me true.
I, every time Elvis takes a verse. It's screaming.
The scream. And also, this is radio. You can't see it, but Elvis can't help himself. He is moving like a slithering snake. I mean, and every time he just lifts his shoulder, and not to mention his hips, even on Witchcraft. You know, everybody in the audience is just going nuts, which, of course, is what had happened to Sinatra just a few years before.
Right. Again, the documentary is called Sinatra, All or Nothing at All, and you can, in fact, see what Sinatra and Presley are doing in that clip. It airs, debuts on HBO April 5th and 6th at 8 p.m. Alex Gibney is here with me on Soundcheck. So he says he hates rock and roll, doesn't believe it's going to be around, now finds himself doing it on stage, on TV, with Elvis Presley. Earlier in the documentary, he talks about what he hopes to do as a singer, and he says, I don't want to be one of those guys who goes out and sings Stardust, the Hoagy Carmichael song, because everybody does that. And a few minutes later, there he is out on stage with Tommy Dorsey singing this gussied-up, tarted-up version of Stardust.
Right, that's right.
So there are a couple of occasions where he says he doesn't like something. It's a very uncomfortable scene of him with the fifth dimension.
Very uncomfortable.
So,
and it's on his show. So there's a certain amount of self-mockery there, but still he's in this glittery outfit that was looks extremely bizarre, and he's clearly completely out of his element.
Yeah.
I think he walks off stage saying, "Hey Frank, your generation gap is showing."
Right.
Right.
So he didn't always do it my way.
Right. He tried to go where the people were. And and even, you know, Mo Austin, the great record executive and record producer, talks about how, you know, when they got Reprise, which was a label that Frank Sinatra controlled, you know, initially all the people on that label were Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Rosemary Clooney. But, you know, in the teeth of the 60s, those people were not going to be selling huge numbers of records. And so, you know, Austin says, look, to his credit, Sinatra got that. And they began to sign all these artists like Neil Young and others who would be big, big, big hits.
Right. So he's a good businessman,
yes,
at least.
Yes, he was.
So My Way is one of the 11 songs
it
in
is.
This farewell concert. And we hear a little bit from Frank Jr., and I think this is Tina, the other daughter that we hear in this clip. But this is Frank Sinatra doing My Way at his 1971 concert.
And now, the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll make it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain.
The people who were in attendance that night, the vice president and his wife, the governor of California, Governor Reagan, and his wife. I sat next to Henry Kissinger that night. And Princess Grace of Monaco.
I did it my way.
I remember being terrified that I was going to get hit by a sniper's bullet because I was sitting directly behind Ted Agnew. Terrible thing to say, but crossed my mind.
Too few to mention. I did what I had to do. I saw it through without exemption.
Well, you know, there is an irony to My Way when Alex Sinatra found himself doing it other people's way in the 60s and
Correct.
70s. Although there is that line, I did what I had to do.
Right, that's right.
And
that's right.
Tina talking about sitting near Spiro Agnew, the vice president, already a disgraced character by that point, you know, just kind of highlights the Sinatra's proximity to trouble
that's
throughout
right.
his career.
Yeah, he wouldn't. I mean, it's both admirable and depressing. You know, his loyalty to somebody like Agnew. You know, he was a friend, and so he's going to stand by him. But, you know, Agnew was a crook.
Yeah.
To use Richard Nixon's term.
Yeah. So what do you think of Sinatra having plowed through all this material? I mean, how has your image of the man changed, if at all, from when you set out on this?
No, it's changed tremendously. You know, particularly in the moment, the great moments of his career, when he was the Capitol years, I think are really my favorite. When he is embodying those songs, and he's a character who's grown up with America, with all of its contradictions. So to me, he's a tremendously important historical figure. And, you know, and as they say in Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid.
Mm. Well, those 50s recordings, you know, when the romance with Ava Gardner goes south, oh, and he is just totally bereft.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep,
you feel that in those in the wee small hours, Only the Lonely, those two great concept albums.
I'm a Fool to Want You. What a song that is.
Yeah. I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you. Such a fool to hold you. To seek a kiss not mine alone. To share a kiss the devil has known.
The Poet of Pain.
Yep. But the framing device for your documentary are the 11 songs of this farewell concert. There is a little addendum at the end of the second evening because, of course, he doesn't stay retired.
He comes back out very quickly. I think his retirement lasted 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
He comes back to Madison Square Garden. Jerry Weintraub decides that he's going to enter like a boxer and that they're going to have the ring so that the champ is back.
And then Howard Cosell.
Howard Cosell announces him just as if he's Muhammad Ali
or Cassius Clay.
Yeah. You know, it's a hilarious moment.
Yeah. But the guy has one more hit.
One more big one. And frankly, as ever present it's become, it's one that I'm a huge fan of. And in fact, I used it, a version by Cat Power, in a film I did called Client 9, Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer. It's New York, New York. And to me, this is the anthem of ambition. I mean, it is really all about that kid coming across the river from Hoboken to New York. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. And so as brash and as corny as this is, in some ways, there's a power to it that I find really inspiring.
Brash and corny, not bad words for the young singer from Hoboken, who for a time was the great singer in the English-speaking world.
Dominated American culture.
Yeah. Well, you wrap up the documentary with it, and so we will do the same with the Frank Sinatra's recording of what is officially called the theme from New York, New York. The documentary is called Sinatra, All or Nothing at All. It's by Alex Gibney, and HBO premieres it April 5th and 6th at 8 p.m. Alex, it's a terrific job. It's a great story, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure.
I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap.
Get instant updates from Soundcheck anytime by following us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll tell you when you can listen to live performances happening in our studio, when we've got new interviews up for you to hear, and when we post new videos online. We're on Twitter at Soundcheck and on Facebook at facebook.com/WNYC Soundcheck.